Tales Other World. And today, the most important topic we can possibly talk about in this podcast, in any podcast ever, and that would be beer. And we have Bill Hurley here from Empirical Brewery. Here's where I want to start. It seems that 15, 20 years ago, if we were talking beer, well, first of all, we would only be talking about three or four or five brands, and that's all it seemed there were in America. Yep. Anyway. It's changed, hasn't it?
Yeah. If you look at the history of alcohol in general and you look by country, you're always going to see those kind of shifts from wine to liquor to beer. And what's been happening, obviously, in the United States in the last 20 years has been the shift towards craft beer, which is, there's a lot of different factors that are causing that that we can talk about. But it's a really interesting time to be in this industry, and you're seeing some ridiculous growth out of the craft beer, part of the beer market.
Well, a couple things. First of all, I've learned recently, and you tell me if I'm learning correctly, that the day that there is more consumption of more beer than any other day is July 4th, at least according to the statistics I've read. In America, more beer is being enjoyed today in 2017 than at any other time in our country's history.
That's quite possible, yeah.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
The availability of good product. I mean, you look at, a lot of people in this industry like to look at Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, all that. You know, years ago, you were drinking your coffee at your house before you left for work in the morning.
And it was Hills Brothers
and
Mrs. Olson.
Yeah. You know, the availability of good coffee, whether you like Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts or not, you know, there's a lot of great coffee places out there these days. And the availability of that product, you know, the popularity of it, just they go hand in hand.
It seems that with beer, there's two categories that have exploded.
Mm-hmm.
Psh, that's our explosion.
Okay.
One is foreign beers that have come in.
Right.
And the other, and some of them are quite unique that unless you're a beer drinker, and even if you are, you might not know about. I mean, you and I were talking a little off the air about sour beers from Belgium. It's like, what? You know, even the beer drinkers, they might not know. The other are, you mentioned craft breweries or the small independent operations. I mean, there are so many terms for them now, and I want to talk about that. Are those the two buckets that have kind of exploded?
I guess, yeah. I mean, craft and, you know, imports were actually, if you step back, you're talking about 15, 20 years ago. If you think about the market then, the beer that was brewed domestically, now all foreign-owned companies like Miller and Budweiser, but
they're foreign-owned companies.
Yeah, that's right. They're all foreign-owned these days.
Really?
Great American industry. Another one got bought up by foreign interests. So,
the beers that are left, like the Miller, and I'm trying to think of all of them, but Miller, Budweiser, I think Schlitz is still around. I mean, it's not being brewed in Milwaukee or in St. Louis in the case of Bud.
It's brewed here, but it's not owned by Americans anymore.
None of them?
No.
Wow. Who owns them?
Just foreign companies have bought them all up.
Some Saudi Arabian dude who likes beer?
Constellation brands, things, you know, companies like that, just the mega brands, the global brands that have come out and kind of consolidated some of the larger.
So there are a whole lot of people that are buying those beers still because they want to buy American. In truth, they're not?
There's a lot of bars even that they advertise domestic drafts in their Budweiser and Miller. It's like, well,
not
actually,
really.
The only domestic drafts you have are Sam Adams and a couple others.
Or so the craft beers that might be brewed, for instance, in Chicago.
Yeah.
How many craft breweries do we have just as one city in our city, in Chicago?
You know, last time I looked on, a good source, if you're ever interested, is go on Beer Advocate. They list all the brew pubs and breweries in any given city. And last I looked, it was in the 70 range, I think, for the city of Chicago, maybe. That might have been for the state. I don't recall. But to be honest with you, when you look at the city of Chicago, yes, it's oversaturated with brands, but the majority of those brands are not from Illinois. You know, we actually we still don't have many breweries in Chicago. There's actually only about 7 tap rooms in the entire city. So,
okay.
You know, there's tremendous opportunity for local guys to start up a brewery here, as long as they're going to have a tap room or some kind of, way that the public can touch that brand directly.
Does Denver lead the list?
No, no. Actually, it's been so long. We've had our head so buried getting this brew pub open the last 6 months, I have not been following all the
industry stats. Which we'll talk about. And I do want to talk about more about Empirical brewery and your philosophy? Because those seven that you mentioned want to all differentiate themselves, right?
Right.
And they are all different. So I want to talk about how you feel you're different. But I want to go back to what's going on now with beer in general. So we were talking about both domestic and foreign. I want to talk about foreign first, then I want to talk about all the things that are going on with domestic. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, beer companies that have started out as craft breweries are no longer that,
right,
in my opinion. But you guys have definitions for that, but we'll get to that. So foreign.
Foreign imports.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, 5-10 years ago, again, people hadn't even heard of Belgian beer.
Right.
Didn't know about all, they may have known one or two German beers or Austrian beer, but didn't know about the plethora of other beers that are now available at your local large facility that sells these products. Right now, it's. I mean, you can go into, I'll say it, Binnie's, you can go, or other large places that sell beer, and you can find beers from, beers plural, from Ireland, but that would figure, I guess, right? The UK, that might figure, I guess. But from Japan, okay, that might figure. More than Sapporo, I mean, a variety of them. From China, well, that might figure. From Africa, you know, Tusker, there is such a thing. So, I mean, and they're available.
Right.
Who would have thought that these beers even existed?
Yeah.
You know, and now people are buying them.
I would argue that they shouldn't be there, to be honest with you. You know, my argument for craft beer, or for beer in general, and we can get to the term craft beer, but my argument for beer is it's a good best consumed as fast as possible, and for the most part. You know, there's a few beers that age well, but the reality is it's a product that can spoil. And especially when it's exposed to heat and light, of course. So, you know, when you ship it overseas, it's a bad, bad idea, you know. And in general, the stuff that you're going to be getting from someone abroad is not going to be as good as the stuff that you're going to get here.
Now, that's why when I actually go to some of these countries, when I'm fortunate enough to be in some of these countries, the beer, or for that matter, wine, always tastes better.
Oh, yeah. A million times better.
And that's why?
That's exactly why. Yeah, you know, and that's exactly why Empirical, you know, we are one of the largest startup craft breweries that you've seen in the U.S., and yet we will not distribute beyond Northern Illinois. You know, I've never seen a reason that our existing facility should go beyond that boundary. And to the extent that we wanted to expand our distribution footprint, I would get another brewing facility, frankly.
So I've talked to other people who do what you do. Which is brew beer in part, right? And they have said similar sorts of things as to what you just said. But when it comes down to it, they base what they do on Belgian style.
Right.
Even Far Eastern style or something that they, you know, darker that they might see in Eastern Europe. And then you name the country. You do the same?
You know, we don't play, well, yeah, we do a little bit.
I mean, we all stand on the shoulders of those who come before us, right?
I mean, we definitely have played, we've dabbled with a number of different Belgian ales. We actually had a series of Belgian ales we did called First Law, Second Law, Third Law, Fourth Law. And, of course, it was a single, a double, a triple, and a quad. And we had a lot of fun with
that. Where was I at the time?
And they went over very well.
I can imagine, yeah.
They were good. There's definitely, you know, the craft breweries in the U.S. have definitely been dabbling with some more of those exotic styles. And, in fact, a lot of the Empirical concept when I formed the company was around that idea of exploring new styles. There's a lot of different styles out there, and there's a lot of different ways you can kind of take that style and bend it a little bit and kind of, you know, make it your own signature beer.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things that you can do, a lot of different yeast strains, a lot of different hops, a lot of different grain profiles, different methods of fermentation, et cetera. And then, of course, barrel aging. You can do a lot of that cool stuff. So there's a lot to explore. The question is, what do people want to drink?
And what is Chicago? I mean, we're based in Chicago, but people listen to this podcast all over the world, literally. But since we're based in Chicago, are there different regional styles, and what would be ours?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, what we're seeing right now in terms of popularity, and it kind of dictated what we put into bottles for distribution as well, we're seeing people that are coming into the craft beer market for the first time in their life. And up till now, they were drinking kind of those old school domestics, in air quotes, domestics. So they were drinking Budweiser last week, and they're coming into the tap room for the first time. And the beer that they're kind of going after is our cream ale. Cream ale is a style of beer that was invented right after Prohibition ended. And it was basically it's a cross between a lager and an ale. A lager takes a little longer to ferment, so they kind of sped up the process with either an ale yeast or by raising the fermentation temperature. So all that said, it's got those characteristics that they're used to, seeing in their beer. It just has a lot more flavor and no aftertaste.
So Chicago is sort of an old school city that's kind of slower than some of these other towns?
I think you're seeing it in a lot of the markets. I mean, that can be said of many markets outside of Chicago as well. What you're seeing right now, and I kind of compare it to the technology adoption curve, is you're getting finally into the mainstream, the next 35% of the market who are people that, to the point I made earlier, they'll pay up for their coffee. Because now that there's good stuff available, they get hooked on it, and they get used to paying that $3 for their Starbucks every day. Same thing with beer. They're willing to pay a little bit more. They're not going to attend a lot of beer events. They might attend one a year. They're not subscribing to Beer Advocate magazine. They're not starting breweries. But they're having a lot of fun going to the local tavern. They're trying out new styles. But for the most part, we're easing them in with, lighter styles, beers that are sessionable, lower in alcohol, so in the 5 to 6% range. We're not giving them the double helix, double IPA that's, 12% alcohol or something like that.
Right, and those Belgians that I like so much, that's in there.
And actually, of the Belgians we had brewed, the one that was most popular was the First Law. It was what we call a Belgian table beer. It was the beer that they would brew, the monks would brew when they were brewing the big stuff.
So it wasn't
drink this,
right. So it wasn't the quadruple alcohol, with the 88% alcohol rate
exactly.
Or whatever.
Right.
Interesting, because I'd rather have that, not the alcohol part, but I like the layers of flavoring that the triples and quadruples I think have. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a meal unto itself almost,
Yeah, and there's a lot of variation in the flavor profiles for those styles. So it's usually a pretty good adventure to see what someone's take on the quad is, as an example. So.
Yeah, I love that stuff. Now, let's get back to something that people might understand what we're talking about, and in fact, won't, because terminology.
Oh, yeah.
So it began, I think craft brew was the first term, maybe not, but there are a whole lot of them now. So what are some of the terms, and what do they mean?
Sure. I mean, craft beer is, obviously in general, it's just referring to smaller batch, smaller company beer.
But Sam Adams calls itself a craft beer.
They call themselves a better beer producer. They actually invented their own term years ago, and they started using it in their 10Ks when they were doing their annual reports and stuff. They said they essentially got to the point in terms of their size that they were making better beer. And it really couldn't be compared to craft beer anymore because they'd reached that level of production. So actually, I don't even, I think they would call themselves craft beer, and I certainly think they've got some of the characteristics of craft brewery still, and they celebrate beer, they celebrate the heritage around it, and certainly they've got that that desire to keep the art alive in the beer brewing process. So I would call them a craft beer provider, but they actually invented their own term, better beer. It's pretty cool.
But they're not small.
They're not small. And really, it does refer to that, craft. It refers to the art. And, we're obviously, our tagline is exploring the science of beer, but of course, there's a lot of art to the process as well. So craft beer is just that generic term. Microbrewery is one of the more official terms.
Well, that's my next one I was going to ask you about. Now, as I understand it, I don't want to pick on Sam Adams, but they're an example people know, which is just the point. So they've gotten so large that they cannot be considered that anymore. Are there parameters?
Yeah, and I actually don't know the exact numbers. The Brewers Association has actually changed them up in recent years as well, where you start out with the nano breweries. Those are the really, really small guys. Then you go to the micro breweries, and then you go, there's now even a label called macro craft.
But because there's a cachet associated with being a microbrewery, for example, even if you're larger than that, you still want to market yourself as that. Is that happening?
I don't know. I mean, they throw that term around a lot.
That's my point.
Yeah, I don't know if they would. They aren't officially allowed to once they breach that size limit.
Are there beer police that enforce this stuff?
I think the Brewers Association would probably call
really?
On it. Yeah, I think they would.
Okay, so tell me about, well, I was going to say tell me about Empirical, but first, tell me first about you, Bill. I mean, did you wake up one morning and decide, I know you had a previous career, so you could talk about that, but did you wake up then and say, I want to brew beer?
In a way, I did. There was a morning, specifically in February 2011, where I did wake up on a Saturday morning and I started a spreadsheet. I started the process of kind of planning Empirical out. But there was a five-year period leading up to that where my wife and I and several of our friends were constantly traveling and kind of checking out all the new and latest breweries that were coming out. There were a lot coming out in that time frame. And whenever I would go on a brewery tour, I'd have my BlackBerry. Back then it was BlackBerry, right? I'd have my BlackBerry out taking notes on the tour, like, okay, how big is that tank and how much do you produce and how many different, you know, yeast strains do you use, things like that. So there was a good 4 or 5 years where that's all I was doing, was I was becoming obsessed with this kind of hobby. And
what did you do for a living at that point?
Well, I was a financial analyst for a big bank.
Okay.
And that's why I was into the numbers. That's why I had a BlackBerry, of course, too.
Uh-huh.
And I just, you know, I realized that at some point I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and I figured maybe down the road this would be the way to go. And, you know, the recession was kind of an eye-opener for me, where it was like, okay, my job and my 401k and everything is entirely dependent on the equity markets, which, frankly, I don't think I understand. You know, I don't think anyone understands.
And you were a financial analyst.
Yeah, I was a financial analyst. Yeah. I was very good at it. But the reality is that the markets are, especially when you're dealing with, like, the financial meltdown and the housing market and everything, you know, they were fickle. And I did not want to be a part of it anymore. Also, I'd gotten into financial analysis back, you know, I'd made that decision back in college thinking that I would help people save for retirement, that I would help people save for, you know, college educations and things like that. That was not what I was doing.
Were you doing?
I was picking stocks for very rich people.
And, really?
Yeah. They were getting richer if I was successful. And I really didn't see, you know, the value in I wasn't making the world a better place, you know, and it just, it
wasn't. You think you're making the world a better place by brewing beer?
Yeah. And actually, I think.
And I would not argue with that answer.
The biggest thing is the impact that I hope I'm having, other than just making beer that you enjoy, the consumer enjoys. I hope that the impact that I'm having is a positive one on both the, you know, the employees and the neighborhoods that we operate in.
That's what I was going to say. So the other thing about Empirical Brewery, and I should talk to you about cats before we're done.
Of
but
course, yeah.
But the other, which is how you and I can connect or knew one and of one another.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about Empirical Brewery or any of the local neighborhood beer pubs that I've been, not only in Chicago, but anywhere in the country, they're neighborhood places.
Yeah.
And we don't have enough neighborhood in big cities where people come together and just have a good time.
Yeah, that was, you know,
was that part of the goal?
That was 100% the goal. I mean, the Empirical concept, you know, when that February in 11, I don't know the exact number, but let's say there were 1,400 breweries in the country. We had already, I think we were in year 7 of double-digit growth at that point. I mean, it was growing rapidly, and I knew this was going to be on the drawing boards for a few years, and I didn't want to be entering into a market that was suddenly super saturated.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to make sure if I was going to do it, that I had a reason to do it, a reason that Empirical would stand out. And so the name actually didn't occur to me till years later. But the concept was that I would find a building that was zoned for manufacturing beer, which is not that easy, not if you're going to get the right size, you know, ceiling heights and the right access to water and everything else. In the city of Chicago, I looked and looked and looked for months and months. Finally found one right near my house. Actually, it worked out pretty well. But the other part of the whole crux of the concept was that you basically want to engage the consumer directly and collect that feedback and have those conversations we were talking about earlier where it's like, okay, what beer do you like? What style of beer, you know? Explore new styles with us and give us the feedback on it. Or if we're trying to refine a recipe, tell us which one you like, A, B, C, or D. And so a lot of what we do in the tap room is that. We are either we're refining a recipe or we're just playing with a beer just to see how people kind of respond to it. So what I needed was the whole concept around it was a dynamic tap room just off of the manufacturing facility, which means it has to be located in, you know, a decent area, pretty close to residential territory. And what I found was a building right off of the Metro tracks. So all along the Metro tracks in Chicago, it's all industrial zoned right next to the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of those old school factory buildings, old brick buildings. And in our case, it was a two-story building. I ripped out part of the second floor and I stuck the giant tanks in there. It wasn't tall enough. It was only 14-foot ceilings. So I just ripped out part of the floor and stuck the tanks in that way. But it's right in a neighborhood that has 45,000 people within a mile radius.
And for those who, if you're a Chicago area person, it's Ravenswood, the neighborhood I believe that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to, well, I want to talk a little bit more about Empirical. And you mentioned what part of the philosophy was as far as a gathering place for people being in a neighborhood. What's your beer philosophy?
The beer philosophy, it starts with the quality of the product. So you need to be able to produce a high-quality beer once you've actually nailed down your recipe, for instance. You want to make sure that you can repeat it and not have a lot of screw-ups, frankly. So my philosophy is make sure you invest in your equipment. So everything in the brewery is American-made. We make the best equipment in the world. It's all brand new, which was very difficult to finance, but we managed.
So we make the best equipment to make beer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think America makes the best beer?
Oh, yes, absolutely. 100%,
no doubt.
Yeah, 100% positive we make the
better,
best beer.
Better than those highly touted Belgian beers I like so much.
I mean, obviously, it's apples to oranges there because it's a very different style. But if we were to put up our best Belgian-style ales against theirs, I think we would win for sure.
Better than the real IPAs from where IPAs actually came from.
Right. Oh, definitely. Yes. I mean, we
without
better
than
doubt,
anything from Germany. People who love German beer. I mean,
oh, people love the German equipment too. I mean, a prominent brewery in Chicago just bought a very nice piece of German equipment for their new facility. But the reality is that I think we are the best, and there's a lot of evidence supporting that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's some great people, great stuff out there, and that was the second part of it, is you got to make sure you invest in your people. We have a fantastic brewing team, Jacob Houston and Julia Davis. They are. Just everyone at the brewery just respects the heck out of them.
So where, do you go to school to learn how to beer brew?
Yeah. Actually, there's a few schools, and the best ones in the world are right here in the United States as well. In fact, there's one right here in Chicago. So, a lot of it, though, is these people started out as home brewers, and they got their knowledge actually just working in the craft breweries in the last 5-10 years. A lot of it is that. It's not the formal education necessarily. So, you're definitely seeing the formal education kind of help the industry, but the reality is most of our people that we've seen come through the brewery have been kind of home brewers that were then kind of schooled on the job at other breweries. So, but yeah, we have the philosophy is essentially to be able to make great quality beer, but then listen to the taproom customers, and see what is working, what people really want to drink. So, if I was to brew the beer that I love, it would be pretty much all double IPAs and imperial stouts and single IPAs that are highly hopped. But the reality is I'm not brewing for me. And I think that's the one thing that any great brewer is going to have as philosophy is that I'm brewing for other people and I've got to listen to them and understand
what they want.
Well, hopefully
any restaurateur, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the end of the day, you're serving people, whether it's food or beer or both.
Right. Yeah, and the other part of the philosophy is that you may like the Belgian quad today. Tomorrow you may like an Imperial Stout. And so your taste is always evolving. So if I was to be able to nail down exactly what people want to drink right at this moment, next year it's not going to be the same. And so if you're not constantly evolving as a brewery, then you are going to be left behind. And that's kind of where, if you go back to that definition of craft that we were talking about, versus, kind of the macro beers that are out there. The macro beers, and this is the epiphany that I had in planning Empirical, was actually on a tour of Budweiser. And they were talking about how they would freeze the beer for a period of years, and they would take it out and just make sure there was no recipe drift. Recipe Drift has actually been responsible for several breweries in the past kind of getting shut down because they drifted away over a period of time from what they were originally brewing. So they kind of lost their brand, essentially.
So this company, Budweiser, mm-hmm. actually past tense or currently do this also?
They do this right now, and their strength is that consistency.
Oh, right.
That is 100% their strength.
Totally.
And it's fantastic.
But they freeze beer?
My understanding is, yeah, they freeze for a period of years, and they'll actually make sure.
Who knew?
It's pretty cool. But think about it.
That's a big freezer.
That's also their weakness, right?
How do they defrost it? Doesn't it get messy?
I have no idea.
I've never heard of this.
It was a fascinating. It was literally, I remember walking in the parking lot after this tour, and I was thinking to myself, how can I use their strength against them? And it really was that moment. I said, wait a minute, you know, they're assuming that people are going to want to drink that same beer 100 years from now. And, of course, that's not necessarily the case. I think people are constantly evolving, and their tastes are evolving. And as the market is evolving, there are new opportunities and new beers that are coming out. Tastes are changing rapidly. And so you're seeing a shift away from those macro beers. And it's going to be a steady shift. It's going to continue. And people ask me, you know, what do you think in terms of market share for craft beer, for all beer? You know, what do you think it'll get to? And
what is it now?
I don't know what the official number is. It's probably in the range of 20% on a unit basis.
Okay.
But the reality is, and again, it comes back to what are we counting as craft these days?
Exactly right, yeah.
But I think it gets to 100%, you know.
Really?
And I was saying
there'll
that
be no
in,
room? I mean, Budweiser, Miller, all those companies are going to go
I
out?
I don't think you're going to ever. I think there's no reason for those beers to exist because the beers that we're talking about can
even
now
at baseball
be
games?
Produced at a craft brewery.
I mean, the one place, even though I'm such a beer snob now, I usually don't do it. I go to the import line or I go
right.
to the, you know.
Right.
But having said that, you know, when the Budweiser keg comes down at Wrigley Field, there is, on an 85-degree day, nothing like a Budweiser at Wrigley Field. Do they serve Budweiser still? Whatever the beer is at Wrigley.
Yeah, I don't know what the beer this year
is. I don't
is
either.
I think what you're going to see is, yeah, you're always going to have the benefit of those marketing dollars and the benefit of consolidation, and you're going to see that. They can get their costs down to a point that I definitely could not achieve, so they're always going to have that advantage.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that they're going to shift away from just having that one Americanized Pilsner that they've been depending on for the last however many years. And once people kind of move away from that beer, I've not seen people go back. I've seen a lot of my friends over the years. You know, one of my best friends was a Coors Light drinker. Another one was a Bud Light drinker. They drink craft beer now. And if you go to their house, they don't have those beers in their fridge anymore. So I've seen a lot of people make that transition to craft, and they just don't go back. There's just no reason to, unless they're at somebody's party and that's all that there is to drink, or they're at the ball game.
True enough.
And that's all there is to buy.
So here's another place where Empirical stands out. I go to your website. I think it's maybe the only one in the nation where you see beers served, about us, those sorts of things, you know, at the upper tab.
Yeah.
And then there's a tab that says cats.
Yeah.
I think you're the only one with
cats
that
exclamation
tab.
Point, maybe.
Yeah. Explain the background of that.
So we, you know, obviously Chicago is known for its rat problem.
And really?
Yeah.
We have that?
I think it might be bigger than New York's problem at this point, but it was becoming a real issue for many years. It's I think it's gotten even worse, you know, in
really?
The last couple of years, is my understanding. We don't have that problem at Empirical. We have zero rats and zero mice and zero anything
because
we have three cats. We have three feral cats guarding the manufacturing area. So the genesis of that was that, you know, when we started, we had the grain stored overnight. We'd come in the next day and there'd be holes in the bags. And we had the traditional traps and everything else and poisons, and it was just getting worse and worse and worse. And of course, it got to the point where it's like, okay, we're throwing out, you know, a lot of grain, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of grain a day, and which is not cheap stuff. It's the highest quality grain you can buy for the craft brewing.
How much do you throw out now?
Zero.
And that is because of these cats. Where did mm-hmm. you get the cats from?
So
did you put on a Google that Help Wanted for cats?
Or? No. My wife works for WTTW.
Oh, really?
She had told me about this program that was on, I think it was featured on Chicago Tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through the Treehouse program. It was mm-hmm. Treehouse Society, I think they're called. But they were a very small organization at the time. I think they've gotten much more popular in recent years. But they would go out, they'd find feral cats that were in danger of being, you know, euthanized, taken, trapped by, you know, hurt out in the wild or taken in and euthanized. They would find these high-risk cats, and they're not suitable for adoption because feral cats hate human beings, obviously. So they would...
I think they're afraid of human beings is probably a better way to put it.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. I don't think they really care either way. They just don't want us around.
Right, Well, they've not been socialized to people.
So they're socialized to each other, and they mm-hmm. would take them in small groups, preferably like 2 to 4, and they would put them into a manufacturing situation typically where they had a lot of room to kind of roam around. They would put them in people's backyards and just make sure that they're fed and everything. They'll kind of stick around that one area. But it's a highly effective program because it saves the cats' lives.
So it's not only Treehouse. It's, you know, shelters all over the country that do trap, neuter, return. And what they do is mm-hmm. they trap the cats. They spay, neuter them in Cook County. You have to, by law, vaccinate them for rabies, mm-hmm. which is a good thing.
Yeah.
And then they're put back out to where they came, except hopefully kittens you adopt out, young kittens.
Right.
Or cats you've trapped and you find out quickly they're very, very ill. The right thing to do is to euthanize them humanely.
Right.
But other than that, they're put right back out where they came from. And the city that has not only Chicago but other cities as well, a problem with rodents and what has been quickly discovered, if you put the cats out, the real estate value changes for the rodents, and they're the heck out of there. I don't know why. And once that was figured out, Treehouse, this one organization in Chicago, but others as well, began programs like, I think what it was called here is Cats at Work. The program here, I believe, has had volunteer issues and all of that. But what's most important, and other issues, but what's most important is you've got your cats.
Yeah.
And they're doing what they're supposed to do.
Right.
And now I presume you kind of get the idea. So as those cats age over time, you'll find a way to replace them.
Yeah, I would assume so. I mean, you know, cats live a long time, thank God. So
yeah, they do.
I will tell you, in terms of the effectiveness of the program, it's been 100% effective. There has been nothing in there since the day they moved in. You know, they were in cages initially for 30 days just to get them used to these giant cages and these dog-sized crates, just to get them used to being in the facility mm-hmm. and make sure they were safe and they felt, you know, okay, we're being cared for. This is a good place.
Yeah, and that really isn't the responsibility of the facility that you named the shelter. It's one person, Jenny Schluter, who began this, who's now at Animal Care and Control in Chicago, and she's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, she was great.
Yep.
She was a lot of help.
So tell me about where Empirical Brewery and the cats are located.
So we're at 1801 West Foster in Chicago, mm-hmm. and that's at Foster and Ravenswood. As I mentioned, it's right off of the Metra.
Right near the tracks.
See the train going by all the time. And
you opened a new location.
Yeah, so the original idea when we opened the tap room back in 2015, it was so well received by the neighborhood that I thought to myself, okay, it'd be nice to open another facility, another tap room. That's the way Empirical will grow. It's not going to be through just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It's going to be through new facilities that mm-hmm. can adapt to their local environment. So I was looking for another potential retail location in Chicago. It's a market that we know, and I know there's a lot of other neighborhoods that were screaming for this kind of retail operation. And of course, the tap room was modeled after one of my favorite shows of all time in the 80s, Cheers. And so I wanted the tap room to be that old school tavern. I always say it's before tavern became a bad word. And, you know, it really did achieve that. And it was so well embraced that, you know, people love coming in. They bring their dogs and they bring their babies. And you'll see babies, you know, and dogs in there on Friday night at 7:30 at night. We kind of have the cutoff for 21 only on Friday nights at 8, but right before that, you'll see a lot of babies and dogs and people playing board games and meeting up and ordering pizzas in and everything else. And
well, you know, very, very early on in our conversation, you and I said it's all about community.
Yeah.
And it is important to you to have a place, apparently, where everybody knows your name.
Exactly. And that was really what we had somehow achieved. And I think it was just through that hiring the right people, you know, bringing the right partners in. And when people come in, they're always greeted. And we make sure that they always, if they have any questions about the beer, that that's always first and foremost, that the bartenders can talk about it. They can give advice. It's a lot of fun.
Where's the second location?
So that was the thing, is I was looking and looking, and I finally found a really good spot up on Morris Avenue in Rogers Park. Rogers Park is one of these neighborhoods very far north in Chicago. It used to be a very, very high-end neighborhood, and it kind of went in the decline. Now it's back on the rise again. And I was very familiar with that neighborhood. I lived only probably a mile from this location for 12 years. So my wife and I knew the neighborhood. We did not know this particular location, but it turned out to be a great opportunity. It was already a restaurant a while back, and it did well, but the owner, you know, they own real estate. And they realized, well, we don't want to run a restaurant. We want someone else to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were looking for someone with a brand, local brand, that had a history of kind of doing right by the neighborhood. And so it was a perfect fit. You know, we were looking for a great space that we did not have to build out, that already had the licensing, you know, set, so we didn't have to do anything weird on the licensing to get that in place, that there wouldn't be any significant delays to getting open. So it was literally perfect. And more importantly, this space, like I said, because it had already been open before, it's a proven, you know, everything's in place, it's ready to go. And there's a theater right behind it that hasn't really been in use in recent years. It's been mainly private events. It was a jewel for that neighborhood for so long that now with us in the front of the building, kind of servicing the food and beer side of things, I'm hoping that theater kind of takes off again. It's called the Main Stage Theater, and I think that it will. I think that, you know, people are looking for that property to be successful. The feedback that I'm getting from the neighbors are, you know, they really hope to see comedy acts and music acts back in that space. And it's such a beautiful building that they've really, Tawani Company in Tawani Corporation and here in Chicago, they've done a great job maintaining that property. And we'll be putting in, there's a little retail space right next door. We're going to be able to put in a 5-barrel brew house. We, right now at the production brewery, we have a 30-barrel brew house kind of doing all the big batch stuff. And a 1-barrel brew house that we're constantly brewing for the taproom on, just those experiments that I was talking about earlier. But with this 5-barrel, it's going to give us that flexibility in production that we just, it's unparalleled in the craft industry, as far as I know. I mean, we can do the really weird stuff on the 1-barrel, we can do kind of the mid-tier stuff on the 5, and if a recipe really, you know, hits the, it really does well for us, we can throw it onto the 30-barrel.
Excellent.
So we're going to have a lot of fun when that system goes in.
All right. And the website is, for those coming to Chicago or those who live here?
EmpiricalBrewery.com. It's EmpiricalICAL.
Okay. Bill Hurley, you're making me thirsty.
Yes.
Thank you. That's not a bad thing.
No.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it.